Wonderful. Thank you. A simple but profound song. And thank you, Shelly-Ann, for that story. If you're curious about the rationale behind why we are telling stories this season at Nexus, is because as we approach the stories of Scripture, one of the things I'm convinced of more and more is that we need a better understanding of stories themselves and how they work. We need to develop narrative intelligence. And so this year, by writing, telling, listening to stories, my hope is that we'll start to sort of unpack how stories function and work. So thanks to Kit from last week. That was delightful. And thank you for that mysterious sordid tale this morning. On to Genesis 4 and the story of Cain and Abel. But to get there, we first need to talk about siblings, because in many ways, the story of Cain and Abel is a classic tale of sibling struggle and rivalry. Consider these words from Jeffrey Kluger, author of the book The Sibling Effect, which is just a remarkable book. He says this: there may be no relationships that can run quite as deep or survive quite as long as those among siblings. From the time we're born, our brothers and sisters are our collaborators and co-conspirators, our role models and our cautionary tales. They are our scolds, protectors, goads, tormentors, playmates, counselors, sources of envy, objects of pride. They help us learn how to resolve conflicts and how not to, how to conduct friendships and when to walk away from them. Sisters teach brothers about the mystery of girls. Brothers teach sisters about the puzzle of boys. Bigger sibs learn to nurture by mentoring little ones. And little sibs learn about wisdom by heeding the older ones. And then this line: our spouses and children arrive comparatively late in our lives. Our parents leave us too early. Our brothers and sisters are with us for the whole journey. Something very peculiar and special about sibling relationships. They're probably the only ones who truly understand the formative role our parents have played in our lives. And in terms of longevity, they're often the only people you have a relationship with for the entirety of your life. So they bear witness to your existence, which is a really powerful thing to consider. And yet, powerful as it may be, these relationships are often the location of incredible conflict. Consider birth order alone. First of all, how many of you have siblings? Many of you do. Okay. If you have siblings, how many of you were first born? Fie you. You see right there, already the seeds of conflict are in motion, because research over the past 10 years is decisively sort of proving what firstborns already know to be true. And that's this: you're smarter than your siblings. You are. Google it when you get home. It'll give you bragging rights for Christmas this year or something. You're smarter than your siblings because firstborns receive more mental stimulation in their early years, and hence they're often the most intelligent of the siblings, which is incredibly vexing to the rest of us, I tell you. How many of you here are youngest, last born? What was it like being ignored? Yeah. Ignored. You know, but the interesting thing is the youngest, they never face the expectations or pressure that a firstborn does. And so basically, to the rest of us, you get away with everything. What about middleborns? There's my tribe. We have it hard. We have it so hard, right? We don't get the smarts of the firstborn, and we don't get the freedom of the lastborn. And so we just struggle our whole lives with identity, and it's tough being a middle child. It's interesting, sibling relationships are unique, but they're also at the center of like so much conflict in life, and it starts early. This is interesting, actually. Our children have done some studies over at the museum with some researchers from University of Waterloo. I don't know if your kids have, but they're often there asking kids to be part of studies. This is what they found. Michael Perlman from the University of Toronto, Hildy Ross and her team from the University of Waterloo have found for siblings between the age of 2 and 5, hostilities break out 6.3 times an hour. Do you realize that's once every 9.5 minutes? That's crazy. And all of my children happen to be in that age group right now. If you're wondering why I've gone gray so quickly, I'm dealing with fights every 10 minutes. Do you realize what that does to the mind of a person? It's crazy. And then 82% of siblings report that they either gave or received physical violence from their siblings growing up. 82%. Violence happens a lot between siblings. And so this sibling relationship is unique and complicated, but it's also fraught with tension and conflict. And so with that in mind, you have this archetypal story. It's like the classic sibling rivalry conflict story, Cain and Abel. But their story is much richer than just sibling rivalry. It's a story of what it means to be human. And so when we come to Genesis 4, we're already post-fall, right? We've been banished from the garden. We're self-conscious. We're already awake. We're hiding. We're covering ourselves. We're working. We're full-fledged human beings at this point. And the very first story we get after that is what? A fratricidal struggle that ends in death. And it's interesting to me because I think the story, it essentially offers two ways forward from the fall, the dilemma of the human condition. It's the way of sacrifice or the way of malevolence. And so we pick up the story in Genesis 4. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. Some people think it's a story about farmers and herders head to head. But in the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. And this is the first time we're introduced to the idea of humans making sacrifices to God in the Old Testament. And it becomes a recurring motif in the rest of Scripture. And it's interesting because I, up until even very recently, I used to read these stories of sacrifices and think to myself, how primitive. Like, this just, I just don't get it. What is sacrificing fruit and animals? Like, it just makes no sense to me. It seems so simplistic. And yet lately, I'm coming to think, you know, these people weren't stupid at all. In fact, I think there's something very sophisticated going on here. I mean, this story directly follows the story of Adam and Eve. And so again, it's offering, what is the solution to the story of the human dilemma? We're conscious. We've discovered time. We've discovered future. We know we're going to die. We know good and evil, and we've been banished from the garden, from paradise. That's a big problem. So what do you do about that? Well, the answer seems to be, you make a sacrifice. And I've come to think that I think the idea of sacrifice is probably the best idea humans have come up with to address the problems of the human condition. Sacrifice. What do I mean by that? Well, I've talked about this a number of times before. You might be familiar with the famous marshmallow test. It's something I've chatted about before, but it really gets at this idea. And the marshmallow test is basically this. Give a kid a marshmallow, and then you torture them, essentially. So you take a 3 or 4 year old child, put a marshmallow in front of them, and say, you can have that marshmallow right now, or you can wait 10 minutes, and when I get back, if you haven't eaten it, I'll give you 2 marshmallows. And it's amazing to me that some kids can do this. I mean, it's not easy as a child, right, to conjure up hypothetical futures and choose that over something that's sitting right in front of you. I actually performed the test on my children last night. But with Zoe, it was a shrimp. She really loves shrimp, so I had a shrimp. Put it on the plate. And it was fascinating, because Evie, I gave it to all three of them. Evie and Huxley had chocolate. And Evie pretended to understand me and immediately put the chocolate in her mouth. But Huxley and Zoe, I loved it. You could see the struggle. How much longer? How much? In their eyes, they're looking at a shrimp and a chocolate and just torn. But they made it. I was very happy about that. But it's bizarre, right? Kids struggle to be able to do this. As adults, we're tasked with doing this as well. And that's the idea of sacrifice. Can you give up what is right in front of you for something that's perhaps better in the future? And so you look into the future and you decide, by making today a little less impulsively pleasurable, you'll make tomorrow a little bit more secure and productive. And I think this is exactly what Cain and Abel are doing. Adam and Eve wake up. They're aware of the future. And in the future, there are threats. They're vulnerable. So how do you protect yourself? Well, a pattern begins to emerge within human consciousness. Humans seem to be less vulnerable when they make sacrifices today so that tomorrow might be better. When I was in Chaco Canyon this past summer, remarkable place, and one of the things that I learned there, we attended a lecture in the planetarium about the ancient Anasazi, and one of the things I learned there is how much time they devoted to observing and looking for patterns in the world. And this place here is called Fajeda Butte, and what they found is that these people, I think I might have shown you this before, they would just observe the sun, watch for patterns. And so on the right is winter solstice. They developed a rock, carved a spiral in it, and on winter solstice, the sun shines on the outer two places, and on the left there is summer solstice. A line of light goes right through the middle of it. And they talked about how this would have taken hundreds of years for them to sit and observe and be able to find the patterns that the sky moves in. And one of the things that I'm really interested in, and I believe learning about most ancient civilizations, it's this. They relentlessly looked for patterns. They didn't have the distractions of Netflix that we did, so they spent a lot of their time observing the skies, looking for patterns. And so if you think about humans, they're developing over centuries, observing the way life seems to work, looking for patterns, I think an idea presents itself, and we see it in this story. I think it's this. You know, successful people among us seem to delay gratification. The most successful people seem to be willing to sacrifice something of value. They give up something now, and their future seems to get better. And so this pattern emerges in history. The difference between the successful and unsuccessful is sacrifice. And this is the thing. I think we all know this to be true. We all believe this. This idea, this mantra is everywhere. To be successful requires sacrifice. Whether it's a skill, a business, a diet, education, work, relationships, especially relationships, right? I was reminded of that this summer when I was traveling with my buddies in the U.S. Southwest. You know, there are two types of travelers in my mind. It all comes back to Genesis. There are people who like to travel chaotically and people who like order. I am of the latter variety. I like order. I like an itinerary. I do my work ahead of time. And I'm not so hung up on an itinerary. If you want free time, spontaneity, we can build that in. 2.5 hours for spontaneous play. But we were standing in Colorado, and we had a six-hour drive to Chaco Canyon. And I knew the sooner we could get there, the sooner we could start hiking. And then in the middle of the drive, we're about 2 hours in, and my buddy Riley says, "Oh my goodness." I'm like, "What?" It's like, "Right on the road we're traveling on, Brad, you won't believe this. There's a UFO watchtower and museum. We've got to stop there." I'm like, "Oh, jeez, are you kidding me?" So I was livid because Riley drives me nuts sometimes. This is off the beaten path. So this is where we stopped, the UFO watchtower and junkyard, apparently, and wasted an hour of our time there. We arrived and there were two women, just us and two women, and they both recounted their stories of seeing aliens and UFOs. The one lady had been seen 23 UFOs, the other 13. And then they told us to walk through the junkyard maze there, and they said we would feel something. Energy. I tell you, I walked through, I felt nothing. But of course, Riley's like, "I think I felt something. I think I..." I'm like, Unbelievable. Wasted our time there. Of course, the end of the museum is where they show you pictures of UFOs, and they all look like nothing. Anyway, so we wasted an hour there. We get back. I'm like, come on, let's go, let's go. Riley's like, you won't believe this. 2 miles down the road, there's a crocodile farm. I said, come on, man, really, really. He's like, I really would like to see the crocodile farm. So we stop there, and this is the front entrance. This facility has been accident-free for half an hour. And I said, Riley, I'm doing this for you. I have never seen a more decrepit place in my life. My friend John's comment was, I'm amazed at the use of old tires, garbage, and chicken wire to fence in these crocodiles. It was just awful, and I kept trying to want to hurry, and Riley was like, this is meaningful for me for some reason. I said, okay, make the sacrifice. We will put in the time here. And at one point, we're walking, and one of the employees, or I assume he was employee, he said, hey, do you want to come into this crocodile enclosure and play a game of egg toss? Sure, that makes sense. Sure, why not? So John and I are tossing the egg back and forth about 10 times. Finally, one of us dropped it. It broke. And I said, did we win a prize or anything? He's like, no, you just get to tell people you tossed an egg in a crocodile enclosure. So I'm telling you, that's what I got to do. And then the moment came that I regret, because I'm too much of the order guy. He said, I've got another opportunity for you guys. I said, oh yeah, what's that? He said, for $200, you can wrestle crocodiles. Wow. He said, we train you for 45 minutes. I'm like, oh, that's what it takes, 45 minutes? Then I'll know how to wrestle crocodiles. And then you wrestle a series of three crocodiles. You start with a small one, then a medium, then a large one for $200. And Riley was like, should we do that? And I'm like, I've had enough. We got to get out of here. We've wasted so much time. But I regret that decision so much, because here's the honest truth. If I told you a story this morning about wrestling a crocodile, would that not be the greatest thing ever? Nobody here has wrestled a crocodile. Anyway, I regret that. But there we were. We ended up arriving at night at Chaco Canyon. But one of the things that I've learned through Riley, because he drives me nuts, and I know he's listening to this, Riley, you drive me nuts. So one of the things I've learned is this. Sometimes in our relationships, the only thing that will keep it going is sacrifice. And it isn't long in a relationship before you realize my way of doing things is totally different than this way, this person's way of doing things. And the only way to have a successful relationship, friendship, marriage, whatever, is sacrifice. Seems to always be the difference between successful people and unsuccessful people, be it at work, in relationships, in life in general. The difference is sacrifice. And so we have Cain and Abel, and they're vulnerable because they're herdsmen and a farmer, so they're at the mercy of the weather. And so what they do is essentially bargain with God, bargain with the future, sacrifice what they have now in the hopes of securing a better future. Because it seems to be that something valuable given up seems to result in future prosperity. Something valuable sacrificed seems to please the Lord. And I think it's a very sophisticated idea here. It finds its root here. It still asks an important question of us. What do I need to sacrifice? How do I need to discipline myself? What do I need to forego? How could I make things better? What sacrifices could I make for that to happen? I think that's a great question to ask yourself. In fact, I think you could actually ask yourself that every single morning. What sacrifice do I have to make today to make things better? You have a day in front of you. The rest of today. What could I sacrifice or let go of that would make my life better, my family's life better, this community's life better, culture's life better? If you want a meaningful life, I think that's a great question to ask yourself. What can I sacrifice, let go of? What would it be that would make my life better and the lives of those around me better? And so I think that's what Cain and Abel are doing, sacrificing something in order to bargain with the future. I think it's brilliant. But then, of course, there's the twist in the story. Genesis 4, the Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. And I love this. God frowns on Cain's offering. Cain, you could say, he bargains with the future and it doesn't work. It's interesting to me. You have to remember, at this point in history, people attributed everything to God. So rain, sun, weather, all that stuff attributed directly to God. It's from the gods. And so many of the ways that we would parse out today the difference between what God is doing and what, say, the weather is doing on its own, that's not in view here. And so everything is from God, which means that whatever going on here, God, fate, life, the weather, has not accepted Cain's offering. And what I love about this story is we have no idea why. It's this built-in ambiguity, and for good reason. We aren't told why God doesn't accept the sacrifice. Apparently, that's not important to the story. Maybe God just doesn't like Cain, or maybe Abel tried harder. Maybe it's just a random, completely arbitrary, who knows mystery. And you know where this story starts to become really personal and pressing for me is this. I don't think the point of the story is to try to parse or dissect why Cain's offering wasn't accepted. Did he do something wrong? I don't know. Maybe he did nothing wrong at all. I think the point is this. It's to ask ourselves, what will we do when the same thing happens to us? Because it will. And I think the point of the story is a warning. When life treats you wrong, when your hard work and your sacrifices don't pay off, when you fail for absolutely no good reason, when you have made all the necessary sacrifices, and even then catastrophe comes to you, what are you going to do? And what I love about this story is it seems to sort of scream, life is arbitrary. And yes, in terms of patterns, in terms of how to live well, there's no question, it seems to be a pattern, that the people who sacrifice and discipline do well. You see that play it out all the time. I know so many people, they've made sacrifices, they've done hard work, and they've succeeded because of that. But there are no guarantees. And no matter your worldview, there's a randomness to life that's really hard to account for. Life is very unfair, I would say, in the way it dishes out fate to each of us. And some people, through no fault of their own, like Cain, do the work, do the sacrifice, and then go, what the heck? That there was no payoff. And the question becomes, what are you going to do with that? What do we do with the arbitrariness of life? What we do with that, it matters. And Cain's response is fascinating to me. It says, Cain was very angry and his face was downcast, which makes sense. He's depressed. He's angry, as he should be, as would be expected. Cain's not thrilled that his hard work has been rejected. It's gone unnoticed, hasn't paid off. You know, there's something I think worth thinking about. Very human story. That's how all of us feel when our work or our lives start to feel meaningless or overlooked. And the real question is, what are you going to do? Notice what God says to him. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. I love the language here. It's got these predatory sexual overtones, and God's saying, you're in danger. Life isn't fair, Cain, but you have a choice right now. What are you going to do? And if you do what is right in this moment, you'll be fine, but you're in danger because sin is crouching at your door, and it wants to have its way with you. Look out. Sin is described as like a predator, a stalker. You're in danger. And I think it's true for all of us. Whenever your work has been rejected or goes unnoticed or it feels like it's been overlooked, when your work or your life is not appreciated, doesn't give you what you'd hoped you would find from it, look out. Danger. Sin crouching at your door, stalking at you. There's a fabulous book called The Tiger by John Vallant, Canadian author. It tells the true story in the late 1990s in Siberia of a tiger who tracked and started killing humans, over 30 of them. So they brought in this famous hunter to try to track down this man-eating tiger. And his accounts of, so he would go out after a kill had been found and he would investigate the scene of a tiger killing a human being. And his accounts in this book are chilling. First of all, you will literally shiver reading this book because it's describing Siberia. It's cold there. But the way he describes the way a tiger attacks and kills a human are just creepy. He says, most times humans seem to put up no struggle and basically walked right into the tiger. And so by the tracks in the snow, he could tell that when a tiger pounces, it's usually from less than 20 feet. And there's very little sign of struggle because by the time a tiger pounces, your hopes of survival are not great. It's a fascinating book, The Tiger and Him, playing a tracking game with each other. But I love this picture that God gives us here of Cain, you're being stalked. You're in danger right now. There's still time. You have a choice. The question is this, are you going to open the door to it or are you going to put that monster back on its leash? I have a friend, he works out in Alberta. Probably the most intelligent person I know. His vocabulary is off the charts. He scores in the mid 40,000 range. I did a test this week on myself. I was mid to low 20s, so I was a little embarrassed. His vocabulary, every time I'm just around him, just the way he talks is just, I just feel smarter in his presence. And he teaches philosophy and comparative literature at the University of Alberta. But he's had his PhD for over 10 years now, and he cannot get a full-time job. And so he's adjunct faculty at the University of Alberta. And he consistently and constantly on Facebook complains. And the thing is this, he's right to complain. It is absolutely unfair what universities are doing to adjunct faculty, but that's not the point of the story. It's unfair. But he seems to be wallowing in this self-pity because he's not even making enough money to put him above the poverty line. And you can feel the resentment and angst in him. I worked hard for this. I'm so intelligent. I have so much to offer, and I can't even make a living. And it's interesting, I emailed him this week because I was thinking about this stuff and I had a few suggestions for him. I've seen some academics on Patreon start to make money that way. So I sent him some ideas of things he could do. It was interesting. He typed back and said, I'll think about it. And you know, I thought, that's the difficulty right there. Is sometimes it's a whole lot easier to just wallow in self-pity and to nurse resentment and anger than to actively try to do something. And the reality is life has been unfair for him. And it's one of the areas that this story has become incredibly personal for me because I find this idea a hard one to wrestle through because, you know, sometimes there are things that go on in your mind, whether it's real or perception, whether it's perception or reality, I don't know, but there's a feeling you sometimes get in life, and it's this, when your work seems to go unnoticed, or it feels like you've been rejected, or when your work is not appreciated, or your life doesn't give you what you had hoped you would get from it, look out. Because in that moment where life seems arbitrary and cruel and you're like, I've done the work and there hasn't been the payoff I expected, look out, you're in a dangerous spot. This is like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Wallow in self-pity? Curse life? Get angry with life? Or try something? And you know, it's interesting, as I was reading this story of Cain, I couldn't help but think of parallels between him and what I assume the Las Vegas shooter must have been thinking. Because I almost picture Cain here sort of brooding on his own catastrophe, that this is not fair, his sacrifice has been rejected. And I can picture him sitting alone and letting his fantasies of revenge and malevolence take shape, and I can picture him sort of egging them on. He's opened the door to the monster of chaos, and now he's living with it, and he's allowing it to grow and flourish and take possession of him. And he lets in the monster, and soon enough, the monster owns him. And Cain enters like the desert wilderness of his own mind. He obsesses over his rejection and betrayal. He nourishes resentment. He indulges in ever more elaborate fantasies of revenge. And with that, he encounters Satan in the wilderness and falls prey to his temptation. It's interesting. He turns to evil in order to obtain what doing right would never give him. And he does it voluntarily, self-consciously, with malice. I was interested this week, there's a whole lot of folklore and rock music about musicians who have sold their soul to the devil. Most famously is Robert Johnson, famous guitar player who, at a crossroads, apparently sold his soul to the devil and became a masterful guitar player but died at the age of 27. And if you Google musicians who have sold their soul to the devil, you'll find some interesting things, actually, some weird stories there. But there's this idea, you know what? Sometimes hard work doesn't pay off. Sometimes sacrifice doesn't work. And so you have this folklore of these musicians who said, I want to be so good and I want to be famous, I'm willing to sell myself to the devil. And it's interesting because you get that picture here with Cain. Doing what is right and good would not get me the thing I wanted, so I'm willing to get in bed with evil. And in that moment, you can sort of hear the idea emerge and then him mutter to Abel, want to go for a walk? And then the play's in motion. Cain turns to evil to find the thing good would never give him, and he murders him. And this is so interesting to me, this story. The thing that he wanted to have, the person he wanted to be, is the one he ends up killing. And I know there's something profound there. Abel had the blessing. He had the success. He represented the things Cain wanted. And in the end, Cain kills the very thing he wanted. If he couldn't have it, no one could. This plays out in many ways. I'm recognizing it a lot in my life. What I've come to think is this. So often the person we attack, criticize, complain, and do everything we can to undermine represents the very thing we wish we had. In fact, here's a good exercise for you. Try this. Follow that thought. Follow that lead. Who is the person in your life today that when you speak of them, it is most often in attacking language, criticism, complaints, words that seek to undermine them? Who is it? And I don't mean Donald Trump. That doesn't count. It has to be someone you know. Someone you know. Who is it? And when you figure that out, ask yourself, what is it about them that I wish I had? What is it about them that I wish I was? Who's your nemesis? We all have a nemesis. Next week, Glenn is going to tell a story about his nemesis, and we're going to explore that concept a little deeper. But so often, the people we hate have something we want. That's how it is with Cain. The story is true today. And when Cain is caught by God, notice what happens. So, what have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. You are under a curse now and driven from the ground, which opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you work the ground, it will no longer yield its crops for you. You will be a restless wanderer on the earth. I love Cain's curse. Restless wanderer. And I've noticed that in my own life. that when I flirt with cynicism, despair, resentment, malice, when I allow the narrative of my life to become that I have been treated unfairly, when I allow that to become the dominating story, I think your curse is restlessness, constant sense of restlessness. And I know the ways I suffer from Cain's curse. Because sometimes life is just insufficient, that's fine, but there are other times where I think we play into the idea that life has just treated us rottenly, and the furthest thing from our minds is gratitude. And when that happens, there's a restlessness. And then it's interesting, throughout the rest of the story, Cain is like, I'm going to get killed here. You've got to protect me. You've got to do something for me, God. And it's interesting, God puts a mark on Cain, which I think is this idea of trying to prevent revenge slayings from happening. He's basically, Cain has let the monster off the leash. God's trying to get it back on the leash by saying, hey, if anyone touches Cain now, you're going to get it 7 times worse. And so God's trying to restore order here, but notice a few verses later, it doesn't work. God's trying to restore order, trying to keep revenge from spilling out, but it doesn't work. Lamech, in his Love This Passage, but right at the end, notice what Cain births. I've killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. And with that, the first murderous seeds are planted. God tries to get the leash back on, but it doesn't work. And all of a sudden, we have the idea of revenge playing out. It's interesting. Adam and Eve, what happened to them was painful enough. They become aware of their own vulnerability. In their nakedness, they know they have the capacity for evil, but Cain becomes aware of his voluntary engagement with evil. So that's where we stand at the end of chapter 4. Adam and Eve introduces us to the problem of the fall. We become conscious, aware of our capacity for evil. Then we discover sacrifice is basically an antidote to our capacity for human evil. But then Cain shows up and introduces us to willingly collaborating with evil. And that's where the story takes us and poses a great question for us. Life is not fair. So what are you going to do with that? When your work seems to go unnoticed, or it feels like it's been rejected, when your work is not appreciated, when your life is not appreciated, when the sacrifices you have made for yourself or others, your family, community, when those don't go noticed, what are you going to do? When life doesn't smile on you despite the work and sacrifices you have made, what then? What you seem to do with the arbitrariness of life, it matters. Dave, here's the thing. I know many of the stories in this room. I know some of your stories. And I know enough of your stories to know that life has been pretty harsh to some of you. Many of you, I would say. The pain in this room, to me, is sometimes palpable. And so I know that your lives are difficult. Some of you, the sacrifices you have made, they haven't paid off. And some of you know very well the sting of life not being fair. And it isn't fair what has happened to you. That disease, that accident, that relationship, that child, that work, life hasn't gone how it should. And you feel the reality of the curse. So what are you going to do? What will you do with that? Continue the path of sacrifice, or walk towards resentment and malice? You're being stalked right now, and what you do next is going to matter. Sacrifice or entertain malice? And we're going to take a break from Genesis over the next couple of weeks, because now that we've explored the human condition, I want to give us some tools and some ideas that might help us move forward with what we've learned. But I want us to close with the song the band has already done, because what I love about this song is it leaves us hanging. And so we have the story of Cain and Abel, then we have the story of an abusive husband, and then we have the story of us, with it running in our veins, the poison running in our veins, in that question. So how do we respond? So the choice belongs to each of us. Cain's tale is a cautionary one. May we hear its warning. What are you going to do? Sacrifice or malice?